Future City is made possible by McCormick & Company. Through its Flavor for Life program, McCormick helps teach kids and families in Baltimore how to replace salt, sugar, and fat. More information can be found at McCormickCorporation.com.
Hey, I'm Charles Robinson. Welcome to Future City, the monthly show here on WYPR, where we move the conversation from what's wrong to what's next. This session of the Supreme Court was marked by a sharp turn to the right. The addition of Justices Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch, conservatives had a solid majority to move the court in a different direction. Chief Justice John Roberts, who tried to hold the court at bay from being political, found himself not just defending some of the decisions, but being the deciding vote. We tackle the Roberts Court and its rulings. To add to its complications is the court's addition of its first African-American woman, Ketanji Jackson Brown. We'll talk with legal scholar Robin Skates about the new justice. She has some very strong opinions about Justice Brown's role and her effectiveness in the first year. In our second segment, Mark Graber of the University of Maryland Law School delves into the legal underpinnings of the Roberts Court rulings. We kick off our show with Jesse Holland. He is an author and covered the Supreme Court for the Associated Press. So I'm delighted to have my good friend Jesse Holland, who is a longtime observer of the United States Supreme Court, and is also a journalism professor at George Washington University. First of all, Jesse, thanks for joining us on Future City.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with this idea. You watched the Rehnquist Court, and now we have the Roberts Court. Tell me some of the significant differences that you've seen so far.
Okay, so first of all, thanks for having me on the show. Second of all, there's been more than just the Rehnquist Court and the Roberts Court. Now, we tend to define the Supreme Court around who the Chief Justice is. But in reality, what we see is courts are defined by certain members, not always the Chief Justice. Now, when Chief Justice Rehnquist was on the court, he was considered to be the middle ground. He was the deciding vote. Now, with Chief Justice John Roberts, for his tenure, he has only been the most important vote maybe once or twice. When he first got on the court, it wasn't the Roberts Court, it was the Kennedy Court, because Justice Anthony Kennedy was considered the most important vote on the court. All lawyers aimed their cases at Justice Anthony Kennedy because there was a clear 4 conservative votes on one side, there was a clear 4 liberal votes on the other side, and then there would be Kennedy in the middle. And if you could get Kennedy's vote, you would win the case. Now, since Kennedy has left the court, we thought it was going to become a Roberts Court. And for a little bit, it was a John Roberts Court. John Roberts was considered to be the most important vote on the court. If you could get Chief Justice John Roberts' vote, you were getting at what was considered to be the middle. But what has changed is that Justice John Roberts is no longer the most important vote on the court, because there are 6 conservatives on the court, and you only need 5 of them to win any case. So now people are looking toward people like Brett Kavanaugh to see if he's going to possibly be that middle vote, where if you can convince Brett Kavanaugh, you'll win the case. Because more than likely, people expect on some of these hard cases that Chief Justice John Roberts is going to vote alongside of Justice Kagan, Justice Sotomayor, and new Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. So that would be 4 votes on one side. Now, the other side, I don't think anybody would be surprised to hear me say there are 5 consistent conservative votes on the court. that would be Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, Sam Alito, and Brett Kavanaugh. Out of that five, the only one of them most people think will possibly vote in some other way would be Brett Kavanaugh. So we're still trying to figure out whether this is a Roberts court or is it going to be possibly a Kavanaugh court? Who's going to be that swing vote that lawyers will aim their cases at? Right now, it's still a little too early to tell, but many people think it's Brett Kavanaugh, not John Roberts. So I would argue that this isn't a Roberts court yet. It might be a Kavanaugh court, and maybe down the road we'll find out who's going to be that most important vote on the court.
I want to ask you, Jesse, about this whole idea that this group of conservative justices have had their eye on big picture issues. And part of that is this idea of individual rights versus state rights. There are, during this session, if you will, there was a clear delineation. A lot of people talk about how they ruled in the Mississippi case where regarding abortion. But I'd like to point to this whole idea in the extension of the Heller case, if you will, which allowed people to carry guns outside their home. And this whole idea that said that you have a fundamental right to have a concealed carry permit and without any restrictions. Talk to this individual rights idea that this court has at this point.
Well, I don't know if I would argue as much of it being an individual right position the court is taking. I would argue it more of, since they have five conservative votes, possibly six when you add in Chief Justice John Roberts, I see this court as looking at what they consider to be a liberal swing in the last 30 to 40 years by the Supreme Court. I think they look at it as their job to reverse that swing. All of the major cases that conservatives say the Supreme Court got wrong over the past 40, 50 years, whether you're talking about affirmative action in the workplace, affirmative action at schools, where you talk about individual gun rights, where you talk about the imperial power of the presidency, whether you talk about voting rights, whether you talk about what is considered state rights. And the reason why I don't want to paint them as being individual rights justices, because when you look at abortion, you would say that is an individual right, and this court will tell you no. So I see this court as saying to itself, now that we have the power, and there's no question about whether the conservative wing of the court holds the power or not. You have six votes. In the Senate, we would call that a filibuster-proof majority. They are going to go back and look at cases over the last 40 or 50 years where they say the Supreme Court got wrong. And they're going to methodically, one at a time, reverse these cases because, frankly, there's no way anyone can stop them. This is what, when people ask questions about whether elections matter, well, yeah, elections matter because conservatives won the presidency, conservatives have enough votes in the Senate, and they were able to put on six conservative justices who are intent on reversing the decisions that they thought the Supreme Court got wrong, whether it's gun rights, whether it's affirmative action, whether it's voting rights, whether it's abortion. This court will go back to what they consider classic conservative positions in the law, and they'll do it methodically until they no longer have the power to do it.
Jesse, you and I have been watching this for a long time, and one of the things that was very clear is that there were going to be issues regarding religion, and that it was going to be more paramount than it had been in the past. I note that, there was one case where there was a coach who decided to conduct a prayer at the 50-yard line. Under normal circumstances, I think they would not even entertain this. Tell me some of their thinking as it relates to how religion works into our fabric of life.
Well, one of the things this court is clearly saying is that the classic position of no governmental interference in religion at all is where they're going to stick, and that's where they're going to plant their flag. They say by banning coaches from praying at a public event put on by a governmental entity is governmental interference. Now, the interesting thing about this is going to be when, at the state level, non-Christian religions ask for the same consideration as Christianity gets. For example, at a school in rural Maryland, if an imam wants to do a Muslim prayer at the beginning and end of a high school football game, will he be allowed? We know if a Christian minister wanted to do it, he would be allowed. So this court has staked out a position saying that what we thought of as the classic separation between church and state has gone too far. Well, now we'll have to live with that decision. And the question is, now in our enlightened stage in the United States, given that we now should know better, are we allowing all religions to have these same rights? Or are we saying just a few religions, or frankly, will just one religion, Christianity, have that same right? Now, this court, according to their decision on this case, says that we are interfering too much with religion by banning public expression of it. Will they also defend other religions outside of Christianity in the same manner? That's the next test that we'll see in front of the court sooner or later.
The other thing that I think most people who are listening to us will be watching is this whole idea of sending the debate between abortion back to the states. In a number of states, there were triggers that were in place prior to this ruling of allowing states to have these triggers, if you will. How is that going to play out? Because I read the Alito summary, and in that, he pointed back to the 1600s as to why abortion should not exist. Is that, I mean, I'm kind of confused. I'm not a legal expert, but I'm quite certain you watched that and you were going like, 1642? Were people enlightened in 1642?
Well, one of the things that we can say for sure is definitely on this continent, people were not enlightened in 1642 because they were still practicing slavery and a lot of other different practices that we would not consider enlightened right now. But we'll put all of that aside for now. The decision by the Supreme Court to put the power of banning or allowing abortions at state level has now separated the country in a way that has not happened since the Civil War, where some states are going to allow a woman to choose whether to terminate a pregnancy, and some states are attempting to ban completely any termination of pregnancies. Since this is now a state level decision, there will be some states that will make decision yes, there will be some states that make a decision no. The catch is some states are now trying to penalize people who move across state lines to move to a state that does allow these practices instead of having these decisions enforced on them in their home state. Now we're having state-to-state conflicts. Let's say, for example, you're in my home state of Mississippi. Mississippi is going to be, whether they have not yet or not, Mississippi is going to be one of those states that bans abortion. But the next step is that they want to stop people from leaving Mississippi, going to Illinois to have an abortion. They want some type of penalty on people who move from one state to the other, or they want to try to punish people who are in Illinois who are offering abortions. That then becomes a interstate conflict to a state that we have not seen since the Civil War. And by the way, conflicts between states automatically go to the Supreme Court. There's no other court for that. So for those who thought that the decision in the Mississippi versus Dobbs case ended the questions in front of the Supreme Court, they're sadly mistaken, because these states are already teeing up these battles to keep people or help people move across state lines to get these abortion services. So we'll see where the Supreme Court actually lies when this case comes back to them, when two states are fighting instead of it being a private case between individuals.
One of the more interesting writings came from Clarence Thomas, who suggested that many of these, quote, individual rights are not based in law. Help the audience understand what that whole idea of individual rights versus the state's rights, if you will.
Okay, so having talked to Clarence Thomas several times over the years, one of the things I can tell you that he is definitively saying is either something is in the Constitution or it's not. If it's not in the Constitution, you cannot pretend like it is. So his argument is that the idea that many of what we consider constitutional rights are today are based on an idea of privacy. There, according to Clarence Thomas, and if you look at the writing of the Constitution, the word privacy does not exist in the Constitution. The concept may exist, according to some people, but the word privacy doesn't exist. So according to him, anything based on a concept of something that isn't written in the Constitution, you can't then say it's there. So many of the cases that we've seen over the years that the Supreme Court has come down on, like in gay marriage, like in abortion, like in interracial marriage, all revolve around a concept of privacy that people have read into the Constitution while the words are not there. So Clarence Thomas will tell you that unless you find the specific words in the Constitution, you can't say it's there. This is why you see all of these cases that he listed in his objection to, he voted with the people, the justices on the court, to overturn Roe v. Wade. But he also said there are other cases that we're going to have to look at again. And those include cases like gay marriage. He says if they're based on the concept of something that's in the Constitution, but the words are not there, you can't make a constitutional case for it. It has to go back to the states. So this is why you see so many people worried about gay marriage and affirmative action and other issues like that, because if you read along with Clarence Thomas, he's going to say, show me where in the Constitution this is. And if you can't point out those specific words, he and other people who agree with him will say, this is not the business of the federal government. It has to be decided state by state.
Obviously, this term has upended a lot of what people call stare decisis, which is, you know, precedent that has been in place for years. Obviously, this majority has come to the conclusion that those can be overturned. I want you to look ahead real quick and talk about two cases that are likely to come before this court. Probably the one that I know I'm watching, like you are watching, is this case out of North Carolina regarding whether or not the state Supreme Court can rule on what the legislative body has done as far as creating districts. Is this worthy of the Supreme Court kind of tackling this particular subject?
Okay, so I don't want to let this slip out of my mind. Let's talk about stare decisis first.
Okay.
Stare decisis has always been a fallacy. Judges use precedent when they want to, and they ignore precedent when they don't. If stare decisis was real and binding, you never would have had an overturning of Plessy v. Ferguson. Because the justice would have said, well, you know, we decided this before, so we can't change it now. The idea that we put so much into the idea of to the concept of precedent has always been ridiculous. All courts, just like legislatures, are about power. Who has the votes? Right now, the conservative wing has the votes on the Supreme Court. So precedent only matters when they want it to. So let's just, the idea of people screaming up and down about precedent, you can put that out of your head for the foreseeable future, because the word you're looking for instead of precedent is power. They have the power to overturn these cases, and they're going to. Now, let's talk specifically about the case in North Carolina. The case in North Carolina is, do the courts in North Carolina have the power to force the legislature to change the voting districts in that state? Well, if you look at the U.S. Constitution, these words are actually in the U.S. Constitution. The power belongs to the legislature. It doesn't say the power belongs to the legislature with review by the courts. It only says the power belongs to the legislature. So by strict reading, once again, we get back to that whole Clarence Thomas thing of, are we going to do only what the words specifically say, or are we going to follow our normal practices? The Constitution says the legislatures have the power to draw these lines. Now, the practice has been the legislature has the power to draw the lines. The court then reviews them. That's how things have been done. But you can argue that the Constitution said it does not put a place for the courts in this process. And that's what's being argued in North Carolina. Just because the legislature has the certain power to draw lines whatever way they want to, according to the Constitution, there is no place for the courts to review it. Now, the courts, of course, I will always be shocked if any politician, and by the way, judges are politicians, if any politician voluntarily gives up power. The court has always given itself the power to review these lines. So here we go back to the Supreme Court again. Will the Supreme Court say, we're going to remove the judicial branch from the power of reviewing these lines in states? Or will the Supreme Court say, hey, well, you know, the Constitution doesn't say the courts can be involved, so we're going to remove the courts from this? I will always be shocked if a politician voluntarily gives up power. So I have to say, this is one of the cases where I don't know which way this one's going to go, because the Supreme Court might just say, as justices, we need to continue our power of being able to review these type of cases instead of going by what the Constitution says, which is the legislature has the power to do this.
Well, I'm guessing you are not going to be bored in any way by what the United States Supreme Court is going to consider and do. That's Jesse Holland. He's been following the courts for a number of years, and he continues to follow them. He's a journalism professor at George Washington University. Thank you, Jesse, for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jesse Holland. Holland is an award-winning journalist, a professor, and author. He covered the United States Supreme Court for the Associated Press. I'm Charles Robinson, and you're listening to Future City here on 88.1 WYPR. We don't want you to go anywhere, but before we go to break, how about listening to the oral arguments which gutted Roe versus Wade? Scott Stewart is the Mississippi Solicitor General.
Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey haunt our country. They have no basis in the Constitution. They have no home in our history or traditions. They've damaged the democratic process. They poison the law. They've choked off compromise. For 50 years, they've kept this court at the center of a political battle that it can never resolve. And 50 years on, they stand alone. Nowhere else does this court recognize a right to end a human life. Consider this case. The Mississippi law here prohibits abortions after 15 weeks. The law includes robust exceptions for a woman's life and health. It leaves months to obtain an abortion. Yet the courts below struck the law down. It didn't matter that the law applies when an unborn child is undeniably human, when risks to women surge, and when the common abortion procedure is brutal. The lower courts held that because the law prohibits abortions before viability, it is unconstitutional no matter what. Roe and Casey's core holding, according to those courts, is that the people can protect an unborn girl's life when she just barely can survive outside the womb, but not any earlier when she needs a little more help. That is the world under Roe and Casey. That is not the world the Constitution promises. The Constitution places its trust in the people. On hard issue after hard issue, the people make this country work. Abortion is a hard issue. It demands the best from all of us, not a judgment by just a few of us. When an issue affects everyone, and when the Constitution does not take sides on it, it belongs to the people. Roe and Casey have failed, but the people, if given the chance, will succeed. This court should overrule Roe and Casey and uphold the state's law. I welcome the court's questions.
Welcome back. I'm Charles Robinson, and you're listening to Future City, the monthly show here on 88.1 WYPR, where we move the conversation from what's wrong to what's next. On today's show, we're looking at the United States Supreme Court, specifically the Roberts Court. Our next guest has been watching the court for a number of years. Mark Graber is a law professor at the University of Maryland Law School.
First and foremost, I am pleased to welcome to Future City Mark Graber. He's a professor at the University of Maryland in Baltimore. First of all, Mark, let's talk about the Roberts Court, because it has put forth several rulings this year that may have shocked some people. But in addition, it has changed the landscape as to how this court is approaching law, if you will. I want to begin with this. Give me your sense of who and what the Roberts Court is these days.
Well, we might call it the Trump Court or the McConnell Court. It is a court committed to the constitutional vision of the far more conservative side of the Republican Party. It is a court that has little interest in past precedents made by courts that were more centrist or even slightly left of center. So it's a court where, to some degree, I'm going to teach it this semester, any law before 2000 doesn't count for much.
Is that by design because of the type of justices that now are on the bench?
Yes, this is a court packed with justices who reject the basic principles that have structured American law ever since about 1933, 1937, the New Deal. So it is not simply, as was the case for most of Richard Nixon's judges, that, well, these judges preferred a more conservative understanding of long-accepted principles, while, say, Lyndon Johnson's judges preferred a more liberal. These are judges that are rejecting both the rights and structure principles of the New Deal state.
I know a lot of people will point to the court's decision to send the Roe Wade decision back to the states. Give the audience a clear understanding of either the legal framework or their thinking as to why it should go back to the states?
Well, it's a good example. Once upon a time, the legal framework accepted by both Democrats and Republicans was there was a right to privacy. Abortion was a part of that right. And then there were fights over whether parental consent laws were consistent with that privacy right or inconsistent. And more liberals wanted fewer restrictions on abortion. More conservatives wanted more restrictions. But there was a general agreement on the right. Now what the court has said is there is no right to abortion. Indeed, the court has intimated there is no right to privacy. It's an entirely different way of thinking that it's not simply there's a fight about this, where the center is. Is it here or is it here? It is eliminating the right altogether and letting state legislatures decide whatever they want.
I note that normally the justices will kind of couch this in a law. Judge Samuel Alito, who was the individual who actually authored the majority opinion, suggested somehow that because it was not something that had been in law before, that that was one of the legal reasons for not continuing it. In fact, he went to back to a 1600 ruling by a judge in England to justify what he did. That seems a little bit of a stretch. Is that kind of the constitutionalist idea that if you can't find it in law, then it doesn't exist in law?
Well, that was Alito's claim with respect to abortion. Though we'll see in other matters, people don't care what happened in the 16th century. The difference is what Alito said is that when the Constitution was framed in 1791 and 1868, there was no constitutional right to an abortion. Therefore, there is no right. What courts have more traditionally done is not simply going back to 1868, but looked at precedents, judicial and otherwise. What Alito said is actually there have been 50 years of precedents, but they're all wrong. That's what courts do when they're initiating a revolution. What courts do in normal time is worry less about what happened in 1791 than what's been going on in the last 50 years.
I want to shift to another court case that this Roberts Court dealt with, and that was on concealed carry. It stems from an earlier case commonly referred to as the Heller case. Tell me how the justices moved from the Heller opinion to the current opinion.
Well, what the Heller case said was you have a right to a handgun for self-defense in your home. What this case, New York State Rifle and Pistol versus Bruin, held was you have a right to carry that pistol or handgun for self-defense outside of the home. You might have to get a license, but a state can't deny you the license if you meet reasonable conditions. Now, here there was a problem since there weren't big urban cities in 1791, or even for that matter, cities like New York in 1868. What the court said is we don't see legislation of this kind in 1791 and 1868. So it must have been a fundamental right, and we're going to protect it.
Another case that came before this court was one involving this idea that if you're a religious institution, that this court will be more lenient or favorable to your arguments. Help us understand that one.
Well, not quite. What the court has said is, imagine you have a law and the law makes an exception. If the law makes an exception for anyone, it almost always has to make an exception for the religious believer. So to give a point that three justices and possibly four have agreed on, if a law mandating vaccines says, well, you don't have to get a vaccine if it might kill you, well, then you don't have to get a vaccine if you think it might kill your soul for religious reasons. Or in a case in Philadelphia, Philadelphia said, if you're working placing foster children, you must be willing to place them in same-sex households. Well, the law, in theory, said someone might be able to make an exception. No one ever had. Supreme Court said there's the possibility of an exception. Therefore, you must make an exception for Catholic charities. Allow them to place children in foster homes, even though they will not place children in same-sex homes.
I guess the thing that observers of this court have begun to surmise is that as this court continues down this path, if you will, that they are of the opinion or of the ilk, if you will, let's get as much stuff in that we couldn't get in before. Is that your sense?
Yeah, that is my sense. And in one sense, I could easily imagine if there were a court of five people who agreed strongly with me and they thought their position was a little precarious. Okay, let's, you know, do what we can do. But this court clearly now believes it is mandated to follow a conservative revolution. And this term is just a start. There are a number of cases in the pipeline that we're likely to see other conservative goals. Affirmative action, for example, may not last next year.
I note that there's also a case regarding voting rights, as to whether, I know it's a North Carolina case, they decided not to take up the case, but they are of this idea, at least some of the justices, that they want to revisit this case. Explain to the audience what's at stake here.
Well, what's at stake is whether state legislatures, when making voting rights decisions, must follow the state constitution as articulated by the state court. The constitution talks of state legislatures. Now, until a few years ago, everyone thought, well, of course, it's the state legislature as described with the powers under the state constitution. A state legislature cannot exist in the absence of a state constitution. But now, conservatives are saying a state legislature can make voting rights decisions, and they cannot be overturned by a state court interpreting a state constitution. And the extreme version of this is the people vote for candidate A in the presidential election. The state legislature can say, that's a mistake. We're going to cast the electoral ballots for candidate B.
I know there are a number of protests that are going on involving the justices. One in this state I know at least two cases where there were protests outside of the justices' homes in Maryland. There's both state law and federal law that governs this. Explain to the audience what that is and how protests and demonstrations can and can't be carried out.
In general, there are bans on residential picketing. That is to say, you can't congregate for a long period of time in front of somebody's house as a matter of protest. Now, you can take that protest to the public park, to march down the streets, but there are things called time, place, and manner. So as long as the law is neutral, the law cannot say no protest of abortion in front of people's houses, but the law can say you cannot do a standing protest right in front of a person's house, no matter what you're protesting.
I note that, rulings by Supreme Courts don't always please everyone. And be it conservative, liberal, or in between, this is what you ask for, and this is what you get.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you're in the business of pleasing everybody, when the president calls you to say, want to be a Supreme Court justice, say, no, I'm keeping my job at the circus. No matter what the court does, it's not going to please everybody. And this is the court, unlike some past courts, say Justice Kennedy, for example, handed down some decisions that please liberals, some decisions that please conservatives. He really didn't know where he was going. This is a court that pleases 25% of the people 100% of the time, or probably more accurately, 90% of the time.
I note that, as a watcher of this court, is there anything that will be a tell, as they would say in poker, that you're watching for?
I think we've had our tells. I think the crucial question was the court going to move to the right slowly, as Justice Roberts wanted, or full speed ahead? And both the Dobbs decision overruling abortion and the praying football coach indicate full speed ahead. And the reason for the praying football coach is the praying football coach had a terrible set of facts. They were in conflict. The coach was claiming, I just want to do a silent prayer alone. When I want to be alone, I don't usually go to the 50-yard line of a football game after a stadium. I don't usually write a letter to the editor saying, I'm going to do this, come join me. So you might think a court that wanted to go slow would say, you know what? We're allowed to say, big mistake taking this case. We're not even going to bother taking the case. Go away. This court took the case. Said, coach can pray privately on the 50-yard line. They have not explained to me how one can pray privately on the 50-yard line after a football game, but I don't agree with other things they say either.
Mark, thank you so very much for joining us on this conversation. I don't think I got any more clarity from you than what I got from what they ruled on. And it'll be interesting to see how they continue to shape how the court looks at legal issues.
Now, I tell my students, my job isn't to justify, it's to report.
Now you're getting in my business.
Thanks, Mark Graber,
from the University of Maryland Law School. I'm Charles Robinson, and you're listening to Future City here on 88.1 WYPR. We have to take another break, but don't you go anywhere. In our next segment, a conversation about the impact of the newest African-American female judge on the Supreme Court and what effect she will have on the court's decisions. Before we go to break, let's listen in on the oral arguments in the Dobbs versus Jackson case. It was the case which gutted Roe v. Wade. Here's a back and forth exchange between Justice Sotomayor and Scott Stewart, the Mississippi Solicitor General.
With those values, Justice Breyer.
I'm not sure how your answer makes any sense. All of those other cases, Griswold, Lawrence, Obergefell, they all relied on substantive due process. You're saying there's no substantive due process in the Constitution, so they're just as wrong according to your theater.
No, Your Honor, we're quite comfortable with Washington versus Glucksberg and how it analyzes substantive due process, and it looks to text history. It looks to history and tradition to discipline the inquiry
well,
and make sure.
I mean, in Obergefell, there was no history of same-sex marriage.
And I think the court pointed out. Look, when we were facing Loving versus Virginia,
I'm not trying to argue that we should overturn those cases. I just think you're dissimulating when you say that any ruling here wouldn't have an effect on those.
Respectfully,
that no state is going to think otherwise? That no people in the population aren't going to challenge those cases in court?
I mean, Your Honor, we'll always have a diversity of views, but I think that's one of the benefits of our society.
Isn't that the point?
That there's a diversity of views and people can vigorously debate and make decisions
exactly,
themselves.
And that's what we're still doing, and that's what we're doing under undue burden, but we haven't been doing it on the viability line.
And neither one has worked well. The viability line discounts and disregards state interests, and the undue burden standard has all of the problems that
we've
emphasized.
How is your interest anything but a religious view? The issue of when life begins has been hotly debated by philosophers since the beginning of time. It's still debated in religions. So when you say this is the only right that takes away from the state the ability to protect a life, that's a religious view, isn't it? Because it assumes that a fetus is life at when? You're not drawing your. When do you suggest we begin that life?
Your Honor, I'm putting it aside from religion. I think there might be more than one question, and I'll do my very best, Justice Sotomayor. I think this court in Gonzales pretty clearly recognized that before viability, we are talking with unborn life with a human organism. And I think the philosophical questions Your Honor mentioned, all those reasons that they're hard, they've been debated, they're important, those are all reasons to return this to the people, because the people should get to debate these hard issues.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Charles Robinson, and you're listening to Future City, the monthly show here on 88.1 WYPR, where we move the conversation from what's wrong to what's next. It is clear the court, with a majority of conservative judges, has moved to the right. Robin Skates, a professor at Morgan State University and the University of Baltimore, has watched the court shift. She has some strong opinions about how they are deciding cases. I also ask her what the addition of an African-American female judge to the court will mean.
So I'm joined by attorney Robin Skates, who's also an adjunct professor at the University of Baltimore and at Morgan State University. First of all, thank you for joining us on Future City, Robin. I want to begin with this. The Roberts Court has made its impact during this session. What things did you see?
I mean, I think that everybody has always known that the Supreme Court, even though they're not supposed to be political, are political. And I think that the Roberts Court, with the majority Republican selectees, have proven that the court is corrupted by politics. So they are a reflection of what we see in Congress and other aspects, and just perpetuating Republican ideologies that are really archaic and also go to the heart of attacking, as far as I'm concerned, women rights and minority rights as well.
There were several cases during this session that came up where the justices didn't necessarily use legal arguments, but were grounded in this idea, if you will, that there are what they would describe as personal rights versus states' rights. From your legal perspective, try explain that to the audience.
So to be honest with you, I don't think anybody can explain that, because it doesn't make sense. You know, a lot of the attacks that they're doing has to do with the 14th Amendment and right to due process and privacy. And that is definitely an individual right. That's an individual right. When it comes to abortion, when it comes to marriage, when it comes to a number of things, those are individual decisions, and contraceptives, and I'm mentioning that because that is something that we probably are going to see in the future. But when it comes to those things are very personal to each individual, because we all, no matter if we are Republicans, Democrats, Independents, whether we're Baptists, Protestants, whatever we are, we normally all have our little, you know, nuances of how we feel we want to be treated. And so, again, those things are individual personal rights for people to do. Legal rights are normally things that are provided to us in the law specifically, and different protections. And those would be, like, a legal right is that you have a right that if I put my purse down, then no one's not going to come and take something that doesn't belong to them and steal it. And then we have penalties for those types of things. So those are type of more things that you can kind of are no-brainers. But when it comes to personal rights, of our rights to privacy and due process, and to have, you know, right to liberty and pursuit of happiness, those things are more personal rights that the court under the Robinson Court has seemed to kind of attack. And normally, if we look through history, those attacks normally happen toward, again, women, minorities, gays, and people who are necessarily are vulnerable in the United States. Normally, they are decisions that are made primarily by white males to decide who has this right and who doesn't have that right. And so that's the difference. The court really, truly is supposed to do an interpretation. And it seems like the court here is doing a little bit more than interpreting laws. They're again, exercising their own individual preferences. And that is not what the court was set up to do.
Speaking of how the court sees itself in this current environment, one of the things they are kind of moving in the direction of is giving states more control over what goes on within their borders. That has not always been the case.
No, that hasn't always been the case. And in fact, especially during Reconstruction and also, you know, Jim Crow times, then the courts have seen that the states, due to, you know, their politics and also some racist, outdated behavior, they have not made the best decisions. And it's been pushed to the court to kind of smack them on the hand and say, no, you cannot do that. You can't treat people the way that you believe that you want them to be treated. You can't keep people in a box. And so they took away some of those rights where they saw that the states were not providing the due process and the privacy rights and the voting rights and those types of things. They intervened to say that they were unconstitutional. Now, what again, the Republican selected justices are doing is giving it back to those states, knowing that states like Texas and Mississippi and Alabama are traditionally and have throughout historically been run by Republicans. And so they're pretty much saying that they're giving it back to their friends to make the decisions that are going to be aligned with the Republican way of thinking or old, outdated way of thinking. And that is what they did. They did that. You saw that in them overturning Roe versus Wade. You saw it in that. So now we have almost 50% of the states shooting down abortions, right? But what they don't see is that it's the funding that came about under Roe versus Wade allowed not just about abortions, but it allowed the care that women needed it for their bodies to prevent cancer, sexually transmitted diseases, unwanted pregnancies, all types of things. When they take those funds away, and so now you don't have clinics and you don't have you don't have Planned Parenthoods and those types of educational types of institutions, now you're leaving it vulnerable to minorities who don't have medical care. A lot of those facilities provided well women care, which we need, and that is detecting breast cancer, ovarian cancer, all types of things. So again, it is separating the have from the have nots. You know, abortion in the United States has lowered significantly. So again, those places were not clinics and healthcare centers weren't just doing abortions. They were doing other vital needs for women who don't have a lot of money. Okay. So again, it's an attack on, again, women and people in our society that needed healthcare. Cause we know it's not all the same. Everybody doesn't have money to pay for healthcare.
I think as people will watch this process unfold, this is not the end. In fact, I think if I'm watching from afar, I would say this is a unique beginning of how reproductive health care is going to be administered in the country.
Oh yeah, it is the beginning. And if we and again, I'm under the belief that you need to pay attention to what people say and what they do. So when you look at Justice Thomas, right, who was supposed to be an African-American male from the South that understands the plight of African-Americans in the history of the United States, his opinion, concurrent opinion, was that they not only need to look at this law as far as Roe versus Wade, but you also need to look at same-sex marriages, contraception, again, the ability of people to get birth control, really? Really? And also, again, same-sex marriages and also same-sex sexual interactions. So again, they are going for the gusto with, again, when you look at contraceptives, when you're saying that, then the only people pretty much that you can be going against in the United States are women, are women's bodies and their decisions for their bodies. And the key thing about the contraceptive argument is that was a case where the state was trying to interfere with a married couple's right to get contraception, a right to say that, you know what, we have relationships, but we don't necessarily want every relationship to turn into having a child, right? And so again, the impact of that is, you know, now you're going to have people having babies that can't care for babies, right? You're going to have people having babies that don't have any business having babies. I used to work for the Maryland Department of Aging and be over the foster care, legal representation for foster care kids in the state. And we, of course, in that particular role, you see a lot of people who have abused children. So again, when sometimes when people tell you they don't want to have a child, they don't need to have a child. Okay, because you don't need a license for that. And yet, again, the Republicans don't want to put money in a system to help support medical assistance, food, and those types of things. They're calling that welfare, and they want to reduce those types of things. But yet now you're putting a system in place that are going to allow women to have children that have been raped by some people. Maybe it could be incest. It could be a number of horrific things that are not going to be a great outcome from a baby who was not conceived through love. Let me put it that way. So again, there are huge numbers of impacts from this, and people are trying to just look at this layer. Even abortion, people who have been against abortion, they're not looking for all the impact of it. So again, it's like we're going backwards instead of forward.
I want to shift gears because as this new term begins, there's a new dynamic on the Supreme Court, and that is Justice Ketanji Jackson Brown.
Right.
Obviously, she is just one justice, and currently in this process, there are not enough votes on the court to change basically the outcome of any conservative idea that the justices, from a legal perspective, have come up with. What do you anticipate her role may be in the overall process? I understand that each one of the justices basically gets a case, looks at it, sends an opinion around to everyone, and then they begin that discussion. What's your sense of how that dynamic is going to change?
I mean, to be honest, Charles, I'm not hopeful. I think what's good about Justice Brown is that one, the majority of, in fact, I think all but one, and maybe she is too, you know, they all have an Ivy League background. And I find that you know, Ivy Leaguers seem to connect with each other, right? So that's that little old boy network type of thing. So I think that she is definitely like in the in crowd because of that background. So maybe I'm just being hopeful because I'm always trying to be hopeful. Maybe they will listen and be respectful of maybe some insight that she can offer, especially as being an African-American female. And so she's going to be speaking from a different dynamic from her experiences as a Black woman in the United States. So maybe she will have the finesse in order for her to get through to them pertaining some issues that are, you know, that are unique to, you know, her being an African-American woman, you know. But when I look at that, there are at least six Republican appointees on the Supreme Court, and she's one person. And I think that sometimes we think that we put all of our eggs in one basket and think that Black person, that African-American person is going to be the one that we're going to ride and we're going to be able to do everything. And I'm not that optimistic to say that, right? I think that it's great that her voice and her presence is there. A lot of the greatness in that is, to me, is the generations to come, our young people, especially young little Black girls, seeing that they could actually be a Supreme Court justice. I think that encouragement is great from a symbolic standpoint, but actually being on that court and you only having one voice, one vote, I think it's going to be a hard thing to swallow. And then I also think the history of the Supreme Court is that you've had some very conservative appointed judges come on the court. And you've seen over time, when you look at the history of the court, where the judges have changed, that they've grown, right? So you have a lot of new judges on the court. And so my hope more so is that with Justice Brown coming on, bringing a different lens to look at things, and then these other judges getting a little bit more mature in their role, that they will in some way see a light, and then you'll see a shift, right? Because, you know, but I say that, but when we look at Judge, Justice Thomas, that hasn't happened. He's gotten worse. However, Justice Thomas has not been like the majority writer on most opinions, right? But again, he just puts his two cents in. That is normally not helpful. So I think that Justice Brown is going to have a hard time, but I think that she's strong enough and she's probably been through enough with her career, her education, her pursuits, her growing up. I think she's been through enough that I'm hopeful that she will be true to herself, and that she will speak her truth in those sessions when she has an opportunity to educate the other justices about topics that most of them have no idea about. They have no idea, because again, their background shows that most of them haven't gone through any struggle. You know, they haven't gone, they had a privilege, and coming and making decisions from a privilege is different. And I know people believe that judges are supposed to only look at the facts and only look at the law and apply that, but that's crap. Everybody comes and processes things through their own lenses. And that's why we get so many crazy anecdotal comments from some of the judges, because again, some of them are clueless about what real life is for people who have had struggle in America. They're clueless about that. You know, the justices cannot, you know, Justice Roberts cannot tell you how a woman feels when a woman, or Justice Thomas can't tell you how a woman feels when she's been raped. Not only is she raped, and then she has to disclose that, because it takes time to disclose it. And then you have to deal with the fact that that rape resulted in an unwanted pregnancy. So they have no idea how that feels, and no one can tell them how that feels, because you have to be that person, right? And then have been violated. So they're making decisions and looking at things that don't even impact them, would never impact them, unless they were the other person who got the person pregnant.
I want to get out of here on this, because one of the things I hear is frustration, but is there any optimism in what you see the courts may look at in the future?
I don't know if I have optimism. I think my optimism is, again, putting all my eggs in one basket with Justice Brown. I think that she, if she can speak her mind and her truth and really truly work to educate these individuals, I think that knowledge is power. And I think that with that, that's what I'm optimistic about. I just hope that she doesn't do like sometimes I see people do in corporate America. When they arrive at a certain position, they try to fit in instead of really truly doing their job. So that is what my hope is for her, is that she does her job. And I think her job and her call is to speak the truth, and no matter what, put it out there. Even if she has to write a dissent, she still needs to put it out there to let people know that, again, the court is truly paying attention to the community and is for the community, to remind them of that. That's the only reason they're there, is to protect our community.
That is Robin Skates, And she is an adjunct professor at the University of Baltimore and also at Morgan State University.
And I'm a full-time professor now. I just got my full-time status at Morgan.
Full-time professor. I appreciate that.
And Skates Legal Group.
Thanks, Robin Skates, for joining us. I'm Charles Robinson, and you're listening to Future City here on 88.1 WYPR. The Supreme Court is the final arbiter of law in the United States. It is not the final word on how society operates and navigates structural changes from science, technology, and social interaction. When the framers of the Constitution crafted their interpretation of the nation, they were operating in the world they knew. Did they get everything right? No. Through the ages, norms have changed. What they gave us was a roadmap. This nation will never consider regression. The good old days are simply that. And those who believe it was good for everyone are wrong. Time has a unique way of solving unsolvable problems. Thank you to today's guests for sharing their expertise and allowing us to hear their knowledge. Future City is produced and edited by Spencer Bryant. You can listen to extended conversations with all of our guests and find out more about them by visiting WYPR.org and search for Future City. We welcome your feedback. And you can email us with your thoughts and questions about the show at futurecity, that's one word, at WYPR.org. Before we go, the original host of this show, Wes Moore, stepped down to run for governor of Maryland. We're happy to announce he is the Democratic nominee for governor. We congratulate him on his win. He will face Republican Dan Cox in November. We will wait and watch. Until next time, I'm Charles Robinson for 88.1 WYPR and my producer, Spencer Bryant, and everyone who makes Future City possible. We hope your dreams of tomorrow become a reality. I'm your host, Charles Robinson.
Future City is made possible by McCormick & Company. Through its Flavor for Life program, McCormick helps teach kids and families in Baltimore how to replace salt, sugar, and fat. More information can be found at McCormickCorporation.com.